gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the IP teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you should require technical assistance, please press star, then zero. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host today, Mr. Stuart Davis. Please begin, sir.
Good afternoon, and to some, good morning and good evening. Welcome to today's panel discussion, sponsored by IP Law and Business Magazine and Steptoe & Johnson, LLP. Today's panel will be moderated by Steptoe partner Roger W. Parkhurst, who has practiced patent and IP law and litigation for almost 35 years. He's also past president of the American Intellectual Property Law Association. During today's teleconference, if you have any questions you would like to pose to the panelists, please remember to email them to events@steptoe.com. Roger?
Thank you, Stuart. Well, folks, as advertised, today's discussion is motivated by the question being considered by the United States Supreme Court in the KSR v. Telefax case, namely, what circumstances can make two or more prior art references properly combinable to support a judgment of unpatentability for obviousness under Section 103A of the Patent Statute. We're pleased today to have a panel of experienced IP professionals participating in our panel discussion. Our first panelist, Marion Underweiser, is Intellectual Property Counsel for the Research Division of IBM Corporation, responsible for all aspects of IP legal support at IBM's Thomas J. Watson Research Center, Yorktown Heights, New York. She's a member of IBM's IP Legal Strategy and Policy Committee, where she works on a broad spectrum of issues concerning IBM's IP policies. She's also been working as co-author of IBM's recent amicus briefs in the recent Supreme Court case, eBay, and on the KSR case. Ms. Underweiser previously served as a member of IBM's IP law and licensing team working on divestitures and patent and technology licensing. And prior to joining IBM, she was a litigation associate with a well-known New York IP firm. She has an A.B. in physics from Harvard, a Ph.D. in physics from UCLA, a J.D. from Columbia University Law School, and is admitted to practice in New York and before the PTO. Our second panelist, Gregory A. Chopsky, is patent litigation counsel at Wyeth and focuses primarily on Hatch-Waxman cases. Before joining Wyeth, he was with a well-known Washington, D.C. intellectual property firm. He holds a B.S. degree in biology from Georgetown and graduated magna cum laude from the George Mason University School of Law here in Northern Virginia. Our third panelist, Kevin H. Rhodes, is Assistant Chief Intellectual Property Counsel for 3M Innovative Properties Company, St. Paul, Minnesota, where he's responsible for managing 3M's intellectual property litigation, as well as the attorney representing 3M's consumer and office businesses. He joined 3M in 2001 after 9 years at a well-known Chicago firm where he was a partner and specialized in intellectual property litigation. Mr. Rhodes holds an undergraduate degree in chemistry from Grinnell College and received his J.D. magna cum laude from Northwestern University in Chicago. So we're pleased to welcome Marion, Greg, and Kevin to this panel. I guess it's appropriate for us to make some disclaimers at the outset of our discussion. In particular, except where a speaker expressly identifies his comments to be so, the comments of any of the panelists do not necessarily represent positions of their employers or clients. The discussion is not intended to advocate positions of either party in the KSR case, and you can appreciate that the employers or clients represented by any of the panelists are both from time to time asserting or defending patent infringement claims. Rather, our discussion is intended to be a thoughtful discussion of the issues raised by the KSR case. So, having introduced the panelists and given you an idea of why we're here today. I thought I would briefly try to introduce the topic substantively. As many of you in the audience know, Section 103 of the Patent Statute has been a part of our law since 1952. The Supreme Court initially interpreted Section 103 in the Graham v. John Deere decision in 1966 at the same time that it decided the Adams and Colgate cases. Subsequently, the Supreme Court has applied the law in a few other cases, such as Anderson's BlackRock in 69, Secreta v. AgPro in 1976. And now in KSR, the Supreme Court has agreed to consider the specific question, which is stated to be whether the Federal Circuit erred in holding that a claimed invention cannot be held obvious and thus unpatentable under Section 103 in the absence of some proven teaching, suggestion, or motivation that would have led a person of ordinary skill to combine the prior art in the matter claimed. In KSR, the patentees sued for infringement of a patent that claims an apparatus, which I will loosely call a gas pedal. That claim, and there was only a single claim in that case, claimed a support, a pedal, like a gas pedal or accelerator in an automobile, mounted to that support about a pivot or pivot axis or axle that rotates as the gas pedal is depressed. The apparatus also included, connected to the support, an electronic control or transducer that sends an electrical signal that's proportional to the amount that the gas pedal is depressed. And then this type of system is useful in modern automobiles where you have a computer controlling the engine and operation of the engine so that the control computer sends signals to the fuel injector or carburetor to dictate how much fuel is actually transmitted to the engine to make the car go. The prior art in this case was two references, the first of which included all the elements of the claim except the electronic control. However, a second piece of prior art showed the types of electronic controls that were useful in the claim combination. And the question became, were those two prior art references lawfully combinable as a basis for a Section 103 attack on the validity of the patent in suit? The district court held it was proper to combine those references and granted summary judgment holding the patent invalid. On appeal, the Federal Circuit said that the district court had not made sufficient findings showing any teaching, suggestion, or motivation to combine the references in the manner in which the claim recited, and thus the Federal Circuit reversed and remanded. The infringer petition for certiorari, which was granted by the Supreme Court, and that is the KSR case that we're here to discuss. Interestingly, in this case, petitioner's position is supported by a brief by the United States government, namely the Patent Office, the Department of Justice, and the Solicitor General. So with that factual resume, we've sort of set the table for today's discussion, and I'd like to invite our panelists to become active and get into the fray here. Why don't we start with the question, why is this case an issue so important? Kevin, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Roger. I think, first of all, the reason why it's so important is that this issue is so pervasive in patent law. As the flyer for this conference pointed out, non-obviousness comes up in every examination of every patent application. It's often the ultimate hurdle to getting a patent, and then it's virtually always alleged as a defense in patent infringement litigation is often the key defense that the the defendant may be relying on if they can't come up with anticipatory art. So it's very pervasive. I think beyond that, it's an inherently difficult question that lends itself to a lot of subjectivity. You know, what would have been obvious is a difficult question in and of itself, and then you couple that with the fact that it's what would have been obvious at the time the invention was made, i.e. eliminate any hindsight and try to put either a judge or a jury or even a patent examiner tries to put himself or herself back at the in the shoes of someone at the time the invention was made and eliminate hindsight, and from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the arts. So again, an inherently difficult subjective test, and so I think that means that the standards for the test are very important to try to lend some objectivity into an inherently subjective inquiry. And I think finally, the reason that I think this case is very important is that some of the proposals to change the motivation, suggestion, or teaching test will really have a marked impact, I believe, on the standards for obviousness and the requirements for patentability. For example, if the Supreme Court were to take up the petitioner's suggestion to go back to a synergy test or a new function in a combination of elements, I think that could make life very difficult in the mechanical or other so-called predictable arts in terms of obtaining combination claims. Or if the government's test, which is sort of throw everything into the mix, not have one single test were adopted, I think that would especially give patent examiners the ability to issue obviousness rejections, perhaps based on, you know, not too much more than I know it when I see it, when something's obvious. So those are the issues that come to mind and for me as to why this is an important case and an important issue.
Fine, thank you. Did any of the other panelists want to speak on this question, the importance of the issue?
Well, this is Marion, and one other point that I would add is that there have been agency findings and focus by I think the Congress as well on issues surrounding patentability and certainly around obviousness. There's a National Research Council and an FTC report that are focused on patent quality generally, but that specifically talk about the obviousness standard and potential problems that it may be raising in terms of patent quality in the United States. So there is wide recognition of the importance of this issue from many quarters.
Yeah, I think that the points that have been mentioned by both panelists point out the importance of the decision. I'm sure that everyone involved in the patent system would like to have a system that is balanced and fair, because I think it's well known that the contributions the patent system makes to the American economy and the world economy. But if it gets skewed in one direction too far, it may cause problems. Well, what really is it that the Supreme Court could do in terms of deciding this case? Marion, do you want to pick that up?
Sure. I think one thing, it's interesting here that in a case which was actually an unpublished opinion by the Federal Circuit where they had denied summary judgment, saying that there was a factual finding for the lower court, that a case on that posture, they granted cert on that, showing the Supreme Court showing that they were really focused on what is the content, in my opinion, what is the content of the test itself, that they did want to look at that, and they made their decision after having asked for briefing from the Solicitor General. And as you pointed out, the Solicitor General did submit an amicus brief and did support the grant of cert. So I think that it's not very likely that they would affirm and remand for further findings. I think they're gonna look to do something to either reinterpret or maybe completely change the way that the Federal Circuit is looking at the obviousness test, I think that I suppose there's no way to predict whether or not they would state a new rule or give new guidance. I think it would be good if they did. I think that it will cause a great deal of uncertainty if they don't provide a clear rule when they hear this case. But I do think that it's fair to say that they want to re-examine what the Federal Circuit is doing very carefully.
Anybody else want to comment on what the court could do in deciding this case? I might just add on the point that that Marion mentioned, that the Solicitor General was invited to speak on the, or file a brief on the issue of whether or not certiorari should be granted. It's my understanding that in recent years, the Supreme Court has increasingly requested the Solicitor General to comment on petitions for certiorari, so that fact in and of itself may not be too important. But I think the fact that not only the Solicitor General did file a brief in support of the petition at the petition stage and supported the petitioner's position strongly could be a factor in what the court ultimately decides.
Roger, this is Kevin. I think
sure.
I think you're right on that. I think that both the petitioner's brief and the government brief did a good job of framing the issue as one of whether or not the Federal Circuit has gone beyond the statutory language and the case law in Graham and other Supreme Court cases to craft its own homegrown rule. And I think the eBay case this spring may have foreshadowed what the Supreme Court will do with the so-called homegrown rules from the Federal Circuit. So I think in terms of what the I do think that an affirmance and a remand is unlikely. I think in terms of what the Supreme Court may do here, again, could run the spectrum anywhere from just vacating this opinion and remanding for reconsideration the rule without a lot of guidance, all the way on the other end of the spectrum to some pretty firm guidance if the suggestion in the petitioner's brief is taken up that the Supreme Court ought to reinstitute for so-called combination claims the requirement of synergy or a new function that came out of Anderson's BlackRock and the Socrata cases.
All right. Well, some of those same briefs you mentioned make the assertion that the PTO is issuing too many patents that should not be issued, and that it's too difficult to invalidate patents for obviousness in the district courts and certainly in the Federal Circuit. Greg, do you want to pick up those points and facts and give us some ideas as to whether or not those are true?
Sure. I guess the first thing you suggested was that the PTO is issuing too many patents. And I guess more precisely, the question is, are they issuing too many bad patents or non-inventive patents? Certainly there's a perception that they are, and it's been well publicized. Some of the patents that have issued in recent years, such as methods of swinging and whatnot. So there's clearly the FTC has commented on as well. Whether or not it's true, there's certainly a perception that it is going on. With respect to whether or not it's too difficult to invalidate them, and this might be more my industry talking, but the statistics are pretty high in the pharmaceutical industry on the invalidation. We tend to face a pretty tough road, and often on the back of obviousness. I don't have anything beyond what FTC told me in 2002, but as an industry, we tend historically to lose the cases in about 75% of the time, often because of invalidity under obviousness. So I would venture to guess that, as at least in my industry, we're losing 45-50% of the time on obviousness. So I have trouble thinking that it's too difficult to invalidate patents under 103.
Well, it's interesting. Some people, and certainly the petitioner and some of the amici who supported petitioner, think that it has become too difficult. I read a few of the amicus briefs, and one of them that I read was Intel's brief, which has a section that talks about, you know, this issue in general. And at one point, they say that in the absence, and I'm quoting now from page 11 of their brief, in the absence of a well-documented pattern of courts invalidating patents possessing strong indicia of non-obviousness, it must be presumed that judges will be able to exclude hindsight from their obviousness inquiries, referring, of course, to the references that one of the things that Congress was trying to do in passing 103 was to guard against hindsight applications of prior art. This whole comment reminds me of the statistics that were in existence before we had the Federal Circuit, even after the John Deere decision was handed down by the Supreme Court. The statistics that I recall were that before we had the Federal Circuit and that the appeals of patent cases were going to the regional circuits, that approximately 70% of all patents that got to the appellate level were being held invalid, and of course often for obviousness, whereas the statistics that I understand are the case with the Federal Circuit today are more like those that you just mentioned, that it's much closer to 50-50. So one wonders what this call for statistics in the Intel brief is, and whether or not there's a danger that eliminating some sort of rule like the Federal Circuit's rule may result in a big swing back toward invalidation of an extraordinary number of patents. Does anybody have a thought on that?
Well, you know, Roger, this is Greg. 50% is still pretty high, considering there's a presumption of validity as well. I mean, I have a lot of trouble believing even 50%, if it's across the industry, means it's difficult to invalidate patents under 103.
Yeah, but it's a lot better than 70%. And if we think of litigation as a contest between rational parties, you would think that people that are willing to spend enough money to litigate through the appellate level, that both sides have a sufficiently strong position that in a substantial number of cases, the ratio of winners to losers, patentees versus alleged infringers, might be somewhere in the middle rather than skewed to one side like 70%.
Roger, this is Kevin. I think the other theme that comes out on the litigation issue in the petitioner's brief and some of the amici briefs supporting the petitioner is the difficulty under the current test to get summary judgment. So yes, ultimately, through jury trial and appeal is one way to look at the statistics, but I think the other point being made here is that the uncertainty lasts so long and is so costly to take a case all the way through a jury trial and then perhaps on appeal before there's any real opportunity to prevail on the obviousness defense.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, and further to that same point, it may mean that a lot of parties are motivated to settle before they litigate.
Sure, for all the reasons why defendants want to end cases before trial. The interest is in moving up the real obviousness defense to the summary judgment stage so that you don't have the incredible pressure to settle to and avoid an injunction while you're up on appeal or the other things that happen if you can't prevail on the defense until after a jury trial and after appeal.
Yeah, and I think that we can all, well, I would certainly say that if there were certainty in the test and in how it was applied and the public's ability to determine whether or not the patent was valid, that would reduce the risk and the need for litigation.
You know, to the underlying question of is the PTO issuing too many patents on obvious combinations of claim subject matter, I think it's difficult to generalize. Certainly in certain areas, there are real concerns about patent quality, but you know, on a macro level, the PTO is getting more patent applications, they're issuing more patents, there are bound to be statistically more so-called bad patents, and I think that those patents are more visible now. There are more avenues to enforce patents with the increase of NPEs, non-practicing entities, and contingent fee arrangements to bring those patents to light, and there have been some pretty noteworthy cases, the eBay case, the BlackBerry case, that has sort of shown a spotlight on the so-called issue of patent quality. So I don't know if there were a way to measure it, what the conclusion would be, but I think we're all experiencing a few bad apples is sort of painting the whole picture of the situation.
Okay, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about another issue, another aspect of the briefs of the petitioners and petitioners' support by Amici. And that is, do you think that in those briefs there's an extraordinary reliance upon the pre-103 or pre-John Deere Supreme Court precedents? And is there other history of Section 103 that may be relevant to this discussion that seems to be downplayed? Does anybody want to take that? For example, what about the writings of Judge Rich, who was one of the writers and originators of Section 103?
Well, this is Greg. I mean, certainly you can't fault the briefs that we've seen so far for not pointing to the writings of Judge Rich, for at least two reasons. One, it's not officially legislative history, though he did write it and was involved in writing Section 103, and though he spoke and published about it throughout the 50s and 60s, and in fact until his death. But number two, I don't think, you know, broadly looking at Judge Rich's writings, it would be very helpful to them. I think Judge Rich, at least in his writings immediately following the 52 Act, certainly laid the analytical framework for the motivation test. If he didn't outright call it the motivation test, so it's unsurprising, and I suspect we'll see a little bit more of that when we see the briefs in mid October.
Yeah, I agree there, Greg. I think that what we've seen in the petitioner's brief and some of the amici briefs is a nice framing of the issue, in the sense that the focus is on Graham and Anderson's BlackRock and Socrata, and the argument is the Supreme Court was pretty clear, at least on those last two cases, as to the patentability standards for non-obviousness of combination claims. It required something more than the sum of the parts, mere 7 or 8 years later, the Federal Circuit is formed and immediately throws out that test and says there's no special test for combination claims. So I suspect we are going to hear more on the earlier history in the next round of briefs, but the way the issue was set up in these briefs was certainly to get the attention of the court by focusing on the seeming inconsistency between its precedent and then what the Federal Circuit did right after its adoption.
I suppose on that last point you mentioned about the demise of any special test for combination patents, that some of the briefs that we would expect to see on respondents' side will make the point that virtually every claimed invention is at some level of analysis a combination of old elements which are really operating in their known functional ways. I mean, short of discovering a new chemical element, that sort of analysis would hold true. So that when you talk about even what the court was saying in AgPro and BlackRock, they surely had in mind that they were talking about not only a combination of old elements doing something more than just the mere functions that each of the elements have, but producing in concert some result or combination that was non-obvious over what went before. I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the briefs to come. A related question on the history of Section 103. You recall that in Deer, the court was pretty explicit about saying that they understood the passage of Section 103 to be a mere codification of the progeny of Hotchkiss v. Greenwood. Do you think that was overplayed in Deer, and that there's more balance than that in the Supreme Court and Federal Circuit precedents? I hear a deafening silence.
Well, I mean, certainly the legislative history tells you it's just a mere codification and not, the banishment of a whole area of law that seemed to be not workable. So clearly they have the better side of the proof of that argument. But I would turn once again to the writings of the people who were sort of on the ground at the time, and I think once again Federico and Rich and later Markey will tell you that it was an adoption of some of the law before the act, but was a repudiation of a lot of the law, the case law that was completely devoid of any standard.
I think the case law was so varied that you cannot say there was a prevailing view that the act codified. I mean, there were so many different tests, that, Roger, as you pointed out, in different circuits. In the Eighth Circuit, where I am right now, was notorious for not having upheld a patent for years prior to the creation of the Federal Circuit. And, various courts articulated tests like the flash of genius test. So I don't think there was a codification of any kind of prevailing view of it here.
Yeah, I agree with
prevailing
that.
Case law that had been developed very well.
I don't think it was a prevailing view. I think there was a lot of minority views.
Yeah.
And what the act did was take what the writers thought was the best of those and dump the rest. It was such a flash of genius test.
Yeah, I think Cuneo went down the drain.
For example.
I think that the notion that it was codification, as my understanding, got into the legislative history because this was 103 was only one part of a sweeping codification or rewrite of the patent laws, and that in order to get it through Congress, they were making statements that were general and were not necessarily specific, so that's one reason that got into the legislative history. If you read Judge Rich's papers, a collection of which, by the way, appears in the volume 14, number 1, 2004 issue of the Federal Circuit Bar Journal, I think you see that he definitely believed, as one of the authors of 103, that it was a codification and more, and that they were trying to provide some more objective matrix by which patentability could be established, and they were trying to get away from this hit and miss notion of courts trying to determine what was or was not, quote, invention, unquote. So maybe we'll see more discussion of this in the briefs to come up on the respondent's side. But I think that the statements in Deer we're probably going to have to live with in terms of mere codification, because that's what the legislative history says. Of course, maybe Judge Scalia will get in that mix too, and there'll be less weight put on that. Well, let's move to what we might think was the purpose of the Federal Circuit in adopting its so-called teaching suggestion or motivation rule for combining references as the basis of a Section 103 rejection or attack on patentability. I don't know if any of you in the audience have read the recent Federal Circuit decision in the Alza v. Mylan case, but it seems like Judge Gallarza sort of makes a restatement or a recap of the Federal Circuit law in this regard, and he repeatedly calls it the anti-hindsight jurisprudence of the Federal Circuit, picking up upon one of the reasons for Section 103 that was mentioned in Deere. What do other panelists think the Federal Circuit has been trying to do with this rule? Marion, do you want to take that?
Sure. I think their central purpose in adding the TSM jurisprudence to the obviousness test is to avoid hindsight. What I would say is that these very complete explanations of the test that are very, very clear to say that there's explicit and implicit teachings that are possible are really their recent development since the granting of cert, and I think evidence the fact that the court, you know, is concerned about, you know, what the Supreme Court is going to decide. I think that if you look at the recent cases, one thing that, in my opinion, comes out is that there is some uncertainty here. If we look back to the prior cases, there are certainly a lot of cases where the court seems to be saying, look, I need to see something in writing. I need to see something very clear, and that takes, I think that takes hindsight to an extreme conclusion where you're finding all the bits and pieces. It's almost like a novelty rejection. To the extent that that the cases are decided based upon both, the possibility of an implicit teaching, I think it's very hard to find consistency in their application of that test. So, you know, what are they doing? Well, when they're applying the test in what appears to be a very objective way, and, you know, again, I understand it's to avoid hindsight. I want to see a teaching suggestion or motivation. When they apply the test that way, I think they're avoiding hindsight by requiring something too extreme, acquiring almost a novelty rejection. And on the other hand, when they go the other way, go out of their way to say, well, our test allows for both of these things. An implicit teaching is okay, too, you know, in light of what the posita understands, the person having ordinary skill in the art understands from the art, from the invention as a whole. This is, to me, not a very certain test. So I think that they're finding themselves a little stuck trying to respond to what is a criticism of how they've applied the test in the past.
I agree in large part with the evolution there of the test. I think it's true that given the nature of the obviousness analysis and being inherently subjective, that the Federal Circuit was striving to provide an objective evidentiary framework as to what would be sufficient showing of obviousness or non-obviousness, and in particular to guard against hindsight. And I think initially the case law was a reaction to some of those Supreme Court cases on combination claims that we were talking about, Anderson's BlackRock and Socrita. And I think the court was trying to send a clear message. In some cases, there's the statement that there is no such thing as a special animal known as a combination claim. All claims are going to be treated the same. And I think some of that that dicta has been effectively used as sound bites in the petitioners and some of the amici briefs to show that the Federal Circuit really was deviating from the Supreme Court precedent and imposing an express or an explicit teaching in the art to have a suggestion or teaching to combine. But I think it's right that the test over time has evolved. I'm not sure all the evolution has taken place since cert was granted, but if you go back to cases like Cross Medical from, I think, 2004, the Kahn case, and then the more recent Ormco and all the cases, there is a clear message that the Federal Circuit is sending that the test is flexible, that in addition to an express teaching, it can a suggestion or teaching or motivation to combine can be found from the general knowledge of one skilled in the art, or in some cases from the nature of the problem to be solved. So by adding that flexibility, I agree there is some aspect of subjectivity that's been added to the test, but I think that's a far cry from eliminating the test altogether and having obviousness be determined by an examiner or a court as I know it when I see it. There is some subjectivity, but at least the test still requires some specific evidence, some articulation of why either the general nature of the, or the nature of the problem or the general knowledge would connect to the invention and lead one skilled in the art to be motivated to make the combination.
Well, do you think that the evolution of the test as articulated by the Federal Circuit has really been moving in the direction of continuing to push the Patent Office and lower courts, whether it be in bench trials or in jury trials with special interrogatories to juries, to articulate in their decisions where it is in the prior art or from what source, regardless of source, that they have gleaned one of the TSM elements to combine references, and that many of the, for example, reversals and remands, like in this case, are not necessarily saying it's not there in the prior art, but you just haven't articulated it.
Right. I think that message has been sent clearly to the Patent Office in review of board decisions in litigation, certainly in cases like this that are resolved by the court on summary judgment or after a bench trial. I think that's the message we need to find. The test is flexible, but we need to have evidentiary support in the record for how you got to the conclusion of obviousness. I think jury verdicts can be, depending on the verdict form and other things, more opaque, but in JMAL motions, generally, you get that kind of articulation of what the rationale is to support a jury verdict.
Yeah, and I have the sense that the focus, both in Deere, the legislative history, and now even as late as all the focus on this anti-hindsight jurisprudence is really just sort of a label, and the courts need to think more specifically about the fact that what they're trying to do is they're trying to get a more objective framework to reach a subjective conclusion that's required by this very subjective statute we have, not to mention the complexities that were mentioned at the outset of our discussion. I think when people realize that we've got a statute here that talks about the hypothetical question of whether or not a hypothetical person would have thought something at a time that's much prior in history, relatively speaking, it gets more and more difficult to reach an objective conclusion. And so that if what the Federal Circuit has been doing is calling for an articulation of reasoning, then that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, this is Greg. I think the problem comes, though, when the Federal Circuit seems to demand an explicit explicit teaching. It might be easier for a court judge to say, well, I listened to an expert witness, and he told me, or she told me, that it would have been obvious. But I think it's a little more difficult in the Patent Office when all they have is references. And they've been told not to rely on their common sense. So you could clearly see why the petitioner is frustrated with the Federal Circuit, though saying, as Kevin points out, that it could be the motivation could be found implicit in the problem to be solved. But are they really just giving that lip service and demanding more?
Okay. Well, what do the panelists think about the sort of overriding question of the petitioner and the government are saying, let's wipe out TSM, let's just go back to DEER, that the DEER matrix is enough. Do you think we need something like TSM or in place of TSM in addition to the statute itself and the Supreme Court precedents?
This is Marion. I'm speaking for IBM. We did file an amicus brief in this case, and we proposed an alternative approach. I do think Graham was looking for some additional guidance. The court there was looking for some additional guidance. I think that it's pretty clear they felt they were setting up a framework and wanted more development in the lower courts, which is what the Federal Circuit was trying to do. There have been many years of precedents applying the TSM test, and what IBM is proposing is to work within that framework, but to have a limited shift in the burden of proof, both in examination and in litigation after issuance, where if art is found within the scope of the analogous art, that it would be presumed that a person having ordinary skill in the art would combine those references to come up with the claimed invention. It's a rebuttable presumption. The applicant or the patentee can rebut that presumption, and secondary considerations would also remain pertinent to the overall conclusion of obviousness. Our position is that we would want to raise the bar. We recognize issues with the difficulty of applying the test, and in particular, if you think about what happens in examination, and I know I think Greg was just talking about that with respect to the examiners, the applicant we feel is in the best position to be explaining what their invention is and to balance issues regarding the appropriate scope for analogous art, which as I think everybody knows is keyed on the scope of the invention. The applicant's in the best position to be balancing that scope against what art would be available for an obviousness determination. And so in the course of prosecution, the applicant can narrow the scope of art available for the presumption, can rebut the presumption, and the point is that a public record is created here. You know, the applicant's motivated to be clear, to explain their invention clearly, and to create this kind of public record in response to the examiner that's going to make it much easier for the public and for any court to interpret that patent and that patent record to see whether or not the invention is obvious. One thing I'll point out about Graham is that in Graham you'll notice that the court sets forth some factors, and then when they go to the patent itself and they're trying to figure out if this invention is valid in light of the prior art, they look at the prosecution history, and they look at what the applicant said in the prosecution history when they were talking about the art that was being raised by the examiner. So in Graham, the court certainly felt that this was a reasonable way, this was a good record to look at to figure out, you know, what's really the invention here? How do they get guidance on what's going on? For the sake of the public and for the sake of certainty, I think another way to look at this, or another factor in its favor, is that these are statements not being made by the examiner, these are statements being made by the applicant about the scope of the invention and about the prior art, and they will serve to bind the applicant after prosecution. So the public can rely on this record, and I think that does provide certainty as opposed to the test being proposed by the petitioner and the solicitor, which say, you know, yeah, we know we want to raise the bar, we know we want to address the issues of patent quality, but that don't really provide a workable test and certainly don't provide it in a framework that would be familiar to practitioners.
Well, Marion, is your proposed test one that is workable only in the PTO, or would it also be workable in the courts?
Well, I think it would be workable very well in the courts. I think the point is that you've created this record, and then if a patentee sues for a patent infringement and the issue of validity is raised, you would be within this framework where the court would have whatever analogous art is available for obviousness, and if all of the elements of the claimed invention could be found in the prior art, then that would set up this rebuttable presumption that these elements could be combined.
Does that require some tweaking of the statute on presumption of validity?
No. I mean, if you look at the precedents regarding, and there are certain precedents in particular in the chemistry cases, but it's really a lot like setting up just a prima facie case of obviousness. It's akin to that. And the burden shifting really, I don't think, is significant enough in this context that it would require actually tweaking the statute.
This is Kevin, Marion. My concerns with that test, let me start with prosecution. I'm not sure that there would be a huge difference in terms of applying that test with what prosecution looks like today. I'm not sure that it gets to the underlying problems. If there's an inadequate prosecution, I think you still might face that, because what I think happens a lot today is the examiner finds the claimed elements in the prior art. If he or she is able to find some express teaching or suggestion or motivation to combine, great, but they don't look all that hard for it, and if they can't find it, there's a recitation to the general knowledge of one skilled in the art, or perhaps the nature of the problem to be solved, and that is the prima facie case right there, and you then do shift the burden to the applicant to create the kind of record that you're talking about. Now, maybe if it goes up to the board, there's more of a record created and more rigor around the motivation, suggestion, or teaching. But I think, by and large, your prosecution histories aren't going to look a lot different with this test. That's just my initial reaction to it. The bigger concern I would have is in litigation. I think this is just a limit. I think you'd have to amend Section 282 to enact this test. I think it reverses the presumption of validity. I don't think the analogous art is much of a filter here. I think it's not going to eliminate any of the really the best references. And so what you're going to have is the presumption that anyone skilled in the art would combine anything to get to the claimed invention with no guard against hindsight whatsoever.
Well, with respect to what happens in prosecution, I'll respond to that first. The applicant is actually now in a position where, although I happen to agree with you, I'm not sure if you just left things the way they are, that the course of prosecution would necessarily be so different. I think what is different, I'm not sure, but I think what would definitely be different is that the applicant is now going to be motivated, because of how art is going to be applied to an issued patent, the applicant is now motivated to make sure that it's very clear what the scope of their invention is, maybe when they file their application, and maybe when something comes up during the course of prosecution, but that puts that onus on the applicant, because if their patent is issued without having gone through substantive examination and without having really been examined by the examiner, they run the risk that, you know, all of this art can be applied, and they don't have a record to help a court to figure out, you know, what was really my invention and, you know, how would I respond to this art. That being said, your second point about shifting the presumption of validity, it's really a subsidiary burden shift, And, you know, I don't know how the Supreme Court would necessarily regard it. It's a new test that we're proposing, but it's a subsidiary burden shift. It is not relevant to the overall conclusion of obviousness, or it's relevant, but it's not a presumption regarding the overall conclusion. It just has to do with whether the person having ordinary skill would be motivated to combine the references. And I should point out, with respect to the analogous art, on the one hand, the examiner or the person challenging the validity of the patent still has the burden to show that the art is within the analogous art. And at the same time, we also know that the person having ordinary skill in the art is essentially presumed to have omniscience regarding the analogous art. And I think that it's consistent. I think you can regard that from a policy standpoint as being consistent with that person having ordinary skill in the art understanding how to put the pieces together. Now, you know, as I say, you can rebut this presumption, and there may be many, many ways to rebut this presumption. I don't think that necessarily has to be a restricted thing. But the concepts that we're extending by raising this in the context of litigation are not so different from the other presumptions that inhere in the obviousness determination.
Now, I take it that one school of thought is that the practical impact of this will be that inventors and applicants try to narrow the scope of their claims to render art non-analogous, which might otherwise be used in combination to get the claimed invention.
Yes, absolutely. That would be, the idea would be that they do that homework first.
And what effect, if any, does this test have on the reasonable likelihood of success, which no one's mentioned, but I don't see how this case isn't also a full-scale attack on that as well, since that doesn't really find any authority in the statute either.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Are you talking about preliminary injunction?
No. I'm you're talking about the motivation. I'm asking whether or not if it affects any other aspects of the obviousness inquiry.
It's the counter to the obvious to try, which is not the test. Is the inventor must have a reasonable expectation of success, and there is authority that says that's separate and apart from any motivation, suggestion, or teaching.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out whether or not this new test affects the reasonable expectation of success prong.
Well, I think that if you could show, the way we were thinking of the test is that if you could, I think it would certainly be pertinent as rebuttal evidence to show any kind of evidence relating to reasonable likelihood of success. Something that we've talked about are analogs to things like enablement. But certainly anything like unexpected results or teaching away, anything like that, and that's sort of an extension of it. It's the same logical class of evidence, I think.
Let me add to this a comment that's made by one of our listeners who says they're wondering if this is a workable test because it requires the applicant to prove a negative, and that requiring the PTO to prove motivation to combine would be better because the PTO then has to prove something positive. What do you think about that, Marion?
Yes, it's not. Very often when we first talk about this test, that's what people say. It's not proving a negative. You're not going to scour the earth looking that there is no motivation to combine. You're saying, look, I'm presuming a motivation to combine, and now the evidence that would be relevant to rebut that presumption would be any positive evidence showing that you would not be likely to combine them, that maybe they have things, as I said before, things like teaching away. Things like that you're not reasonably likely to succeed, showing evidence that goes to that. Some of the evidence that goes to secondary considerations, I think, is actually relevant to this as well. They're relevant to both issues. Things like long felt but unresolved needs, failure of others, I think those are actually relevant to this as well. The concept of enablement, just to tell you where that was coming from, and this I think could also possibly be very workable rebuttal evidence, is that in the art, it may be that you're combining two references, and in those references, your enabling disclosure, in either case, doesn't really enable the combination. So kind of what is meant by that, and I think that would be pertinent as well.
Okay, do any of the other panelists, or even you, Marion, want to discuss any other possible replacement or modification of the TSM rule that you've heard discussed and may have merits or obvious flaws?
Well, my opinion would be that, and I think 3M may be coming in on this side as well, that with an emphasis on the flexibility of the TSM test, as has been explained by the Federal Circuit in its more recent case law, so not requiring an express teaching in the art itself of a motivation or suggestion to combine, with that flexibility, we support the current test and would like to see it affirmed.
So, Marion, even IBM, I take it, is not for completely throwing out some such test, but your suggestion is seeking a better procedural mode of making the obviousness analysis.
We're looking for, I think, the real difference between a lot of these different points of view has to do with certainty, and it has to do with public notice. And I think that even though, you know, the Federal Circuit test, from a subjective standpoint, can sound reasonable under their recent formulation, talking about being clear about implicit teaching, I do not think that it's clear to the public or practitioners when and how that's going to apply. I don't think it's clear for examiners when and how to apply that. I think you can find contradictory statements in Federal Circuit case law about common knowledge and the expertise of the examiners. So really, although it's very helpful to the bar to have some guidance that is not, you know, from the existing Federal Circuit precedent, it doesn't provide the certainty that I think is needed to really advance the goals of the patent system, basically, to promote public notice and, you know, and also, we believe, to set the right standard for obviousness.
All right. Assuming, arguendo, that the court is going to either wipe out or change or tweak in some way the Federal Circuit's TSM test, do any of the panelists have a view on the desirability of the court, the Supreme Court, in the first instance, simply stating its present view of what such a modified test should be, or should it perhaps have a discussion of the issues in its opinion and remand the case to the Federal Circuit for the Federal Circuit to recast its rule consistent with what the Supreme Court's thinking? Anybody have a view on that?
Well, Roger, my view on that is if the Supreme Court is going to state a new rule beyond just saying all of this is a gloss beyond the statute in Graham and goes beyond what the Federal Circuit was authorized to do. If the Federal Circuit is going to state a new rule, I suppose it's possible it might pick up one of the suggestions like IBM's suggestion, but I think the most likely outcome is that the Supreme Court would go back to its earlier rule requiring some kind of synergy or new function, and I think that would be the worst possible outcome. So calibrating it in terms of where I think the Supreme Court would announce its rule, I would rather they not and remand it to the Federal Circuit for further development on a case-by-case basis. So I've just argued against the certainty that we've been promoting because I don't like the kind of certainty we might get there.
Any other panelists want to chime in on that? All right. Well, I think this is probably a good point for us to wind up our discussion. We've already spent about an hour and 10 minutes online for our discussion. As has been mentioned during the discussion by the panelists, the respondents' brief and the brief of amici supporting respondents are due in mid-October. Perhaps this case will be orally argued in early next year, and then we'll have the Supreme Court's opinion before the end of the term at the end of June of next year. In any event, I'm sure that we're all going to be looking closely for the day when that opinion's handed down. So let me thank our panelists, Marion, Greg, Kevin. We appreciate your input and participation. And we also thank our listening audience for being here. And for those of you who sent in questions, we have looked at them and appreciate them. So this concludes our program. Thank you very much.